You're listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadler, episode 16, Philo. Sometimes, sitting alone late at night, when the house is finally quiet and my demons emerge, I think of Philo Judaeus. I do realize that when confronted by their anxieties, stresses, and neuroses, most normal people do not think of Philo Judaeus. So a few words of explanation are called for. Philo lived from around 20 BCE to 50 CE in the great and cosmopolitan city of Alexandria, Egypt. By any standard, his literary legacy is astounding. His extant works, written in a decent Greek, span some 12 volumes in the Loeb Classical Library. There are about a dozen other treatises that we know were lost. Aside from a few historical works, almost all of the other treatises appear to have been part of a single coherent project. That project, whose complex nature I will address throughout this episode, is rooted in the exposition of the Hebrew Bible, or more precisely, the Septuagint, since Philo's knowledge of Hebrew seemed to have been rather limited. Philo took scripture seriously and saw in it not just an ideal constitution or law for the Jews, although he did see that, but also deeper universal truths. If Philo's treatment and prose were on occasion labored, his ideas were fresh. This is not to deny that there were some similarities between Philo's approach and that of previous Jewish philosophers, at least to the extent that we know of them through the very few surviving fragments of their work. Aristobulus, for example, attempted to explain troubling anthropomorphisms in the Bible. The author of the Letter of Aristeus consistently understood the Torah as demonstrating reason, an important philosophical virtue. Philo's ideas, though, are far more complex and developed. Philo even achieved some level of fame in his own day. Much against his will, he tells us, the Jewish community of Alexandria roped him into participating in an embassy to Gaius Caligula in 39 to 40 CE. Despite Philo's apparent lack of political involvement until then, his community obviously held him in esteem. Josephus, when describing this embassy, remarks in passing on Philo's skill as a philosopher. Later Christian writers find his writings useful, and it is in fact only through the efforts of the early church and the appropriation of Philo by Christians, especially in the 4th and 5th centuries of the Common Era, that Philo's works survive at all. And that's the point. Philo was a producer of knowledge. Today we would slot him as a member of the cultural elite. He spent his entire life on a single intellectual project, clearly with the hope that others, particularly Jews, would read and be influenced by it. Yet if they did, they have left no record of their engagement with Philo. Philo had Jewish intellectual predecessors, but no followers. Not only did the community for which he was writing not engage his ideas, they didn't even preserve his books or even his memory. Not once do the rabbis mention Philo. I hope that you have heard of Philo Judaeus. But the truth is that it would not at all be surprising if you have not. I do not model my own life and intellectual goals on Philo, but I have to admit that also as a producer of knowledge, the example of Philo rattles me. Like many others, especially academics, I regularly disseminate my research and ideas, letting them loose into the public square. Sometimes, to my relief, others engage my ideas, whether they agree with them or not. Probably more often than not, though, they do not. The ideas float around, buried by the rapid flow of the information that swirls about us. I can tell from Google Analytics, for example, that a healthy number of people will download this podcast, although by way of actual feedback, I receive very little. Is anybody out there? This is not a complaint or self-pity. This is just the way it is for many in this line of work. Philo's example is rattling because it is so egregious. Given the quantity of his output, the novelty of his ideas, the commitment to and coherence of his project, even his platform as one of the very few rich Jewish Roman citizens in Alexandria, how could he be ignored? If his ideas could be forgotten, what awaits ours? This unhealthy mulling usually leads down a logical chain that will be familiar to many. What's the point? Yes, as banal as this sounds, this is the old, what is the purpose of life problem? What is it about the dissemination and reception of my ideas that make me happy? Is that true happiness? Am I happy? Why, given the many blessings that I enjoy in my life every day, am I not always grateful and happy? Where does this all go? One place it goes is back to Philo. Philo's work is frequently and cavalierly dismissed by modern philosophers. Philo, they say, is not really a philosopher, and indeed for one whose understandings of philosophy were shaped by the common streams of philosophical analysis, analytical, continental, even existential, Philo does not appear to do philosophy. Although familiar with many of the philosophies current in his day, his own writing is entirely unsystematic, and his discussions almost always return to the Septuagint. Yet even if his writing would have appeared a little odd even then, Philo wrestled with the same central problems as other Hellenistic philosophers, human happiness and perfection. In Philo's day, philosophy was not an abstract, disconnected exercise. Much of it was applied. It was the contemplation about basic human problems with the goal of therapy. Philosophy was, in a sense, the ancient version of modern psychological therapy, a cognitive process that was supposed to lead to a real change in the self. Philo has been seen as eclectically mixing Neoplatonic, Aristotelian, and Stoic ideas, but his project was much less about academic orthodoxy than it was about people. Philo sought to help us to become better people, and his central insights perhaps remain relevant even today. So let me leave aside these personal musings and start again. What do we know about the life of Philo Judaeus? What did he write and attempt to do in these writings? And what are his central ideas? The answer to the first question is simple. We know almost nothing about the details of Philo's life. Other than his complaint about being drafted for the embassy to Caligula, he himself reveals nothing about the biographical details of his own life. The dates that we use for his lifespan, around 20 BCE to 50 CE, are only approximate, and we know nothing about his parents. Josephus informs us that his brother was Alexander the Alabarch. Alexander was rich and powerful. As Alabarch, he was the Roman magistrate with authority over the customs taxes in Alexandria. We know that he administered the estate of a wealthy Roman woman and made large loans to state figures. One of his children, Philo's nephew, Tiberius Julius Alexander, had equestrian rank in the Roman government, served as procurator of Judea for a term, and then as prefect of Egypt. Josephus condemns him for abandoning his ancestral customs. Another of Alexander's sons, Philo's other nephew, was Marcus Julius Alexander, who married the Herodian princess Berenice. If the trajectory of Alexander's life is any gauge for looking at Philo, we can reasonably conclude that the two brothers were raised with a life of privilege. Few Jews would have had Roman citizenship in Alexandria at that time, and we should assume that Philo and Alexander were born with it. Given Alexander's later career and the erudition shown in Philo's writing, it is also probably safe to conclude that they received a more or less traditional Greek education, with tutors when they were younger, followed perhaps by a stint in the gymnasium. If this would have been a problem for them or their parents, they left no record of their objections. Philo, unlike his nephew, was committed to the ancestral customs as he understood them. Philo identifies only a single source of authentic religious practices, the Bible. He gives no explicit authority to traditional practices, for example. Philo is more interested in scripture as a source of deep truth than he is in looking at it as a source of norms or laws. He thus tends to focus his discussions on the deeper meanings of these norms, particularly of those that otherwise might be difficult to justify. This is what he refers to as the allegorical interpretation of the laws. Philo appears to have had company among Alexandrian Jews who sought to find this deeper meaning of the law. Unlike many of these Jewish allegorists, though, Philo never abandoned what he sees as the literal interpretation of the laws. His understanding of the biblical narrative, as we will soon see, was a bit looser. So in one oft-quoted passage, Philo writes, "There are some who, regarding laws in their literal sense, in the light of symbols of matters belonging to the intellect, are over-punctilious about the latter, while treating the former with easygoing neglect. Such men I, for my part, should blame for handling the matter in too easy and offhand a manner. They ought to have given careful attention to both aims, to a more full and exact investigation of what is not seen, and in what is seen to be stewards without reproach." Philo goes on to discuss in particular the Sabbath and circumcision, writing about the latter, "It is true that receiving circumcision does indeed portray the excision of pleasure and all passions, and the putting away of the impious conceit, under which the mind supposed that it was capable of begetting by its own power. But let us not on this account repeal the law laid down for circumcising." In other words, Philo fully agrees with others that the biblical norms have true, real, and important meanings that we need to carefully uncover. Scripture itself does not give us these meanings explicitly. Circumcision, for example, stands for the elimination of passion, as well as a sense of humility, an acknowledgement that it is God who is the ultimate begetter or father. For these other allegorists, though, as would be the case not long after for Paul, this becomes a cognitive lesson rather than a physical act. Actual circumcision, the surgical removal of the flesh of the foreskin from the penis, becomes unnecessary. Philo rejects this logic, as he does other allegorist attempts to declare unnecessary the actual observance of the Sabbath, festivals, food laws, etc. We might reasonably conclude that Philo himself observed these norms, although we have little information about what Jews in Alexandria actually did. As I suggested, Philo has often been seen as a precursor to Paul, and some more extreme interpreters, even in antiquity, have seen him as a Christian. There is, however, no evidence that Paul read Philo. Both, in fact, emerged from an intellectual environment in which Stoic allegorical interpretation was common. It is through his emphasis on the allegorical interpretation of Scripture that Philo would later become interesting to the Christians. Philo, though, was no Christian, and simply because his work emphasized the allegorical does not mean that he did not think that the literal was critically important, at least when it came to biblical norms or laws. Philo is a bit looser when it came to narrative. The actual truth of most of the biblical narratives seems to matter little to Philo. Unlike our own sometimes rigid division between truth and myth, especially when it comes to the Bible, Philo had little interest or stake in what we would refer to as the literal truth of the Bible. At times, he even rejects this truth. Commenting on Genesis chapter 2, verse 21, "And God brought a trance upon Adam, and he fell asleep, and he took one of his sides," Philo remarks, "These words, in their literal sense, are of the nature of a myth. For how could anyone admit that a woman or human being at all came into existence out of a man's side?" Philo goes on to deride the absurdity of taking this sentence literally. God is above acting like a surgeon. The story is there to teach us something deep and meaningful, not something literally true. It is this deeper meaning or truth conveyed by God in Scripture that Philo is consistently after. This was his life's project. Scholars generally group Philo's extant writings into three works, the first of which we have only a small sample, It's called Questions and Solutions, or Answers. This consists of specific questions on the text of the Torah, followed by brief answers. Both questions and answers mainly concern issues of allegorical interpretation. Only fragments of this work survive, many only in Armenian and Latin translation. We have a much fuller version of a second work, known as the Allegory of the Laws. This is a collection of treatises that works through the book of Genesis more or less sequentially, attempting to give the deeper allegorical truths that underlie the biblical narrative. The story of Abraham's relationship with Sarah and her handmaid Hagar, for example, is understood as an allegory for how humans learn, their intellectual capabilities, and the order in which they might best acquire true knowledge. I will soon return to this example. Finally, Philo's third work is called The Exposition. This begins with a series of allegorized biographies of some of the great men of the Torah, Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, and of course Moses. A treatise on Isaac may have been lost. He then devotes several treatises to categorizing and interpreting the legal norms of the Torah, mainly using the Decalogue as his organizational scheme. The prohibition against adultery, for example, becomes the general rule under which are the specific prohibitions against all kinds of sexual transgressions. In the first and the second of these works, The Questions and Solutions and the Allegory of the Laws, Philo aims to provide a way to read Scripture. The stories in Genesis, which today are frequently read as naive history or moral stories, really convey deep truths about the nature of God and the universe through the use of symbol and allegory. Philo's writings at times become repetitive and tedious, but from a pedagogical perspective, there is an upside. We can begin to see and predict where Philo is going in a given story. While not always consistent, Philo is consistent enough to show that his method of biblical interpretation is not random. Philo, unlike, for example, the authors of the so-called Pesher interpretations found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, does not invoke some kind of divine spirit or inspiration for his authority. Philo attempts to convince his readers through logic and consistent application of his method to the biblical text of the truth of his interpretations. You are compelled, or you aren't. Here, a very brief comparison with the much later Zohar is instructive. The Zohar, the Jewish mystical book produced in 13th century Spain, also is roughly structured as a running commentary on the Bible. The goal of the Zohar, as with Philo, is to uncover the deeper meaning of Scripture, the picture of true reality that's hidden within it. And like Philo, the Zohar uses symbol and allegory in pursuit of this goal. Each story detail is meant to stand for something else, usually in the cosmic realm, revealing ultimately the nature of the Godhead. Unlike Philo, though, the Zohar makes a claim to authority from tradition. Its interpretations are said to come from ancient and venerated rabbis. The Zohar does not have to convince. It only needs to assert its antiquity, which, as it turns out, was not very convincing for many Jews. The comparison between Philo's method of interpretation and that of the Zohar raises the further question of comparison with other modes of interpretation in Philo's day. Philo, it has long been noted, did not create the allegorical or symbolic reading of canonical texts. Some Jews preceded him, but more importantly and influentially, this was becoming the accepted way to read Homer among Greeks in Alexandria. Homer's Iliad and Odyssey were in their own way canonical texts, and both contain details that made contemporary Greeks uncomfortable. Allegorical and symbolic interpretations were also commonly used for the professional interpretation of dreams, much preceding Freud. Philo's method, though, really invites two more specific comparisons. On the one hand, Philo's method is very similar to that of Paul and the early Christians. Paul, too, reads the biblical stories of the Hebrew Bible allegorically. Of course, his allegory is different. For him, the symbols are typological, indicators of the coming of Christ and the allegories concerning the relationship between God and the new Israel. Paul, too, goes far beyond Philo in discarding the literal meanings, particularly of the laws. On the other hand, Philo's method is largely dissimilar to that of the rabbis. The later rabbinic writings very rarely and sporadically use allegory. Their method of biblical interpretation, midrash, relies far more on textual anomalies and juxtapositions. This difference might at least have contributed to the later Jewish neglect of Philo. Rabbinic midrash might in part have been a rejection of the allegorical method used by the early Christians to argue for the solely symbolic value of the law. Throwing out Paul's method, though, means also throwing out Philo's, even if Philo never preached for the abrogation of the law. In this line of argument, Philo suffered collateral damage. Scholars have often compared Philo to the rabbis in order to show that Philo was Hellenized and that his Judaism was different than theirs. The most extreme but influential form of this argument was advanced by a gifted scholar named Erwin Goodenough. Goodenough, who taught at Yale in the first half of the 20th century, published widely on Philo and on the synagogue art at Dura Europis, which you might remember dated some 150 years after Philo and was located in Syria. Goodenough postulated a dichotomy between the religion of the rabbis and the mystical or spiritual Judaism of Philo and Dura. Philo's texts became the key for him for the interpretation of Dura's art. Goodenough's interpretation undoubtedly pushes both Philo and the art too far. At the same time, it raises difficult questions about Philo's intended audience and his goals. The two questions are related. Some have argued, for example, that Philo was writing mainly for a non-Jewish audience, and thus taking some kind of native foreign Judaism and expressing it in Greco-Roman terms. Others, though, have seen Philo's work as aimed at Jews, perhaps to help them better understand a tradition that alienated them. Perhaps Maimonides is the better analogy here. Philo, like Maimonides, may have been writing for an educated Jewish elite who had difficulty reconciling their philosophical and logical assumptions to the text of Scripture. These are good questions, but the dichotomy that they present, Philo the apologist versus Philo the assimilated Jew, is not very helpful. Philo did not devote his life to showing Greeks and Romans how advanced Jews were, or to showing Jews how they can be part of the modern world. These may have been side benefits of his project, but the project's main goal, I think, lay elsewhere. Philo was a philosopher, and like many philosophers of his day, he was interested in the big and important questions that faced us as human beings. What does it mean to achieve happiness or perfection as a human being, and how do we do it? This goal, I believe, comes across more clearly in Philo's third work, The Exposition. Why does he provide discussions of these biblical characters? There certainly is an apologetic flavor to these portraits, especially that of Moses, whom Philo seeks to raise as the divine lawgiver, a position analogous to that of the Greek Solon, but better. But what Philo really wants to do in these descriptions is provide a set of human models for virtuous living. Moses is a kind of extreme case, a super sage, as the scholar David Winston has called him, who through study and action has almost transcended the human to become one with nature. This understanding of the sage is clearly Stoic. For both, becoming a sage was such a big deal that it was virtually impossible, but it served as a goal to shoot for. Fortunately, Philo's other depictions provide more attainable and useful models for achieving happiness. As he writes, "For the Holy Word seems to be searching into types of souls, all of them of high worth, one which pursues the good through teaching, one through nature, and one through practice. The first called Abraham, the second Isaac, and the third Jacob, are symbols of virtue acquired respectively by teaching, nature, and practice. But indeed, we must not fail to note that each possesses the other three qualities, but gets its name from that which chiefly predominates in him. For teaching cannot be consummated without nature or practice, nor is nature capable of reaching its zenith without learning and practicing, nor practice either unless the foundation of nature and teaching has first been laid. Very properly, then, Moses thus associated these three together, nominally men, but really, as I have said, virtues, teaching, nature, practice. Philo thus draws a typology for achieving true happiness. You can get there through the study of philosophy, as exemplified by Abraham. You can get there simply by nature, which, while being the least inimitable of these virtues, is curiously exemplified by Isaac, for whom no treatise is extant. And you can get there through continuous struggle or training, as exemplified by Jacob. Joseph, he tells us elsewhere, exemplifies a life of statesmanship. All are good and possible, but the first, philosophy, he clearly elevates above the others. It is through this lens that we should read Philo's other works. To be an Abraham, to achieve happiness and perfection through philosophy, you need to understand the deeper meaning of Scripture as indicated by Philo. Philo's allegorical interpretations are intended to make you into an Abraham. They tell you the fields of knowledge that you need to master, and then provide a framework for understanding that which is truly real and important about the world conveyed in Scripture. For Philo, truly learning the lessons of philosophy actually, ontologically, changes you, excising your distracting passions. Personally, though, as I think about Philo late at night, it is the type of Jacob that resonates deeper. Jacob is a practicer. Philo writes, "For practicing is by nature an uneven business, at one moment going onward to a height, at another returning in the opposite direction, and at one time like a ship's making life's voyage with fair winds, at another with ill winds. For the life of practicers is, as one has said, a life of alternate days, sometimes alive and wakeful, sometimes dead or asleep. Some days, in other words, are better than others." My point here, though, is that Philo might not represent very much at all. He did what all philosophers of his day did, but using the material of the Bible. He is far from creating or standing for a distinct kind of Judaism, whether we call it Hellenistic, mystical, or anything else. A few minutes ago, I very briefly compared Philo's method of biblical interpretation to that of the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls. We talked in an earlier episode about the creation of this community. Their heyday, though, appears to have been right around the time that Philo was writing. And so in the next episode, we will shuttle back from Alexandria to Judea and join in progress the community living by the Dead Sea, whose scrolls give us one incredible first-hand account of a Jewish sect in antiquity. You have been listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadlow. The original score is by Neil Ginsberg, with vocals by Michelle Tattenbaum. Technical assistance was provided by the Language Resource Center and the Instructional Technology Group, both at Brown University. More information can be found at msatlow.blogspot.com or at mlsatlow.com. on the public education page. I welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.